Today is Monday, May 13th, and you're listening to The Job. This is The Job, a delicious talk show about design, music, business, culture, and Portland. I'm your host, Ray Briglib. Our guest on episode 13 is local designer and troubadour, Bob Smith. But first, let's talk to Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How is the conflict therapy going?
The rejection therapy?
Yeah, that's right.
It's been a little bit harder than I expected. I went into it with a little bit of a, like, hey, if I get rejected, I succeed. If I don't get rejected, it's also will feel like success. So this whole thing is going to be easy.
A win-win.
Win-win.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little harder than that.
Why?
I think, well, for one, I'm going to say, I was using this app.
This $3 app.
Which, you know, we discussed last week. It's awful.
It's awful.
It is the worst app I have ever used. So, for one thing, I have to interact with that app once a day, which mm-hmm. I am done with starting today. I'm just figuring out other ways to get rejected. It is so frustrating. So, it's this list of 30... things to do, and one of
it could
them,
literally be a single, you know, double spaced sheet of paper.
They're typos, like they don't know the correct which "your" to use,
right.
And also, so it's this list, and you click on one, and you might do the thing, mm-hmm. and then when you open the app again, it starts at the beginning. So the later you are in the month, that you have to flip past them. It's not even like remembering. This is something.
It's like the app
done.
Was made by someone with a head injury.
And the one of them was like, you know, ask someone out on a date. It's like, wow, I'm married.
I
probably shouldn't be asking people out on dates.
Mm. You damn well better get rejected if you do.
Yeah, better go for the gold.
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm just saying.
That's true. I guess I could have asked someone out on a date and then said, just kidding, I don't actually want to date you.
I did not think you would say yes.
Yeah. Okay, awkward.
Actually.
No, but it's been good. I've tried every day. So the goal is basically just to get rejected each day.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, like, one of them that was actually really difficult for me and I didn't realize that it would be was offer to pay for somebody else's order. That seems easy. That seems very simple, right? I'm offering to pay for somebody else's order.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in New Seasons, and they have a coffee counter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, you know, like, a few months ago, a few times we would, like, go through the Starbucks drive-through and pay for the person behind you. And it feels really good, right? Because by the time you're paying, they've already ordered. You're paying for that whatever they've ordered, and then you're driving away, and nobody's saying no. You know, it just feels really good. Like, wow, I just did this, like, goodwill kind mm-hmm. of thing. And it's like the penance for going to Starbucks. So I thought, oh, it'll be like that, you know? It'll just feel great.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in line, and nobody came behind me. Mm-hmm. So eventually, I just looked around, and I had to think, like, I'm supposed to try to get rejected, so who here, if I walk up to them and offer them a drink of coffee, you know, free coffee, is going to say no? And I saw these two women, and they were reading a book together, and they just looked really serious.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit older than me, and so I walked up to them and I said, you know, excuse me. And they both shuffled away. Excuse me, excuse me. They're like they were in my way. And I had to sort of get their attention again and, you know, basically just say, would one of you like to order a coffee and put it on my tab? And they looked at me like I was insane. One of them actually wouldn't even look at me. She just looked away and looked at the floor.
Yeah.
And the other person basically just said, no.
Well, you successfully rejected.
Rejected. But I did this like right when I got in the store. And so then I did the rest of my grocery shopping running into them the entire time, and neither of them would look at me.
That's so awesome.
And neither of them would just say, like, why did you do that?
They're like, what the hell is wrong with you? Now you're gonna walk through the store.
Now you're just gonna grocery shop.
You sure
with
you don't
your
want
coffee?
Some coffee? I got coffee here.
That was the awkward thing to me. It's like, at some point, do I just walk up to them and say, like,
look, I'm doing this stupid thing here. Like, oh, you bought that app? I will tell you that if you look on Quora for rejection therapy, there are some much better tips on there. For example, try to hitchhike.
Oh, I've done that. People pull over. That's not very rejecting.
Ask strangers of money. For money, right?
Oh.
Of money. Hello. So here's a good one. Sign up for Greenpeace and harass people on the street. Talk about rejection therapy.
Right.
Well, that is the heart of the maelstrom right there. To stand on the corner in front of like Hawthorne and ask people to sign your clipboard.
And that you only need to get rejected once a day. Could you do that and just knock out like here's
a whole
2 weeks worth.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah. Go to a random company's headquarters and ask to speak to the president. Ask every rich person you know for money or an idea. These are good, huh?
Mm-hmm.
These are
They just seem like they take more work than the ones in the app. The app is like, smile at everyone you pass today.
Facebook. Like, what is the point of that?
Friend a stranger on Facebook. I ignored that one. I don't want a stranger as a friend on Facebook.
I want to add one to the pile of the myriad reasons why that's a stupid thing.
Yeah.
When someone requests a friendship on Facebook, you can just ignore it.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to reject it.
You don't have to actually reject someone.
Here's what I did for that one.
I have
one.
Some people in limbo. They've been there for like a year.
It was friend a stranger on Facebook, and I decided I didn't want any strangers as friends on Facebook, but I thought, I'll go on Instagram and I'll try to friend a stranger that has a private account. That person's going to reject me.
Yeah.
I don't know them and they have a private account.
Yeah.
They did not reject me.
Oh,
they
well,
said
they,
yes.
Oh.
And now I'm looking at pictures of like somebody's child and I don't even know where they live. It's like I know nothing about them. Do I then reject? Do I then like unfollow them?
No. Now you're
right,
in.
So now it's just awkward
now
for
you're
me.
In there, yeah.
Do I start liking things? I feel like this app is putting me in situations, or I'm putting myself in situations via the app that I then don't like. And it's not the rejection thing. It's the like, what do I do with this stranger's kids' photos that I'm looking at? Like, they post a lot.
Thanks, rejection therapy. Now I have this guy sleeping in the couch in the living room, and got all these people I hate who are friends on social networks.
One of them I did. The hardest one that I did was actually the first one, and it was get a hold of someone who shunned you,
mm-hmm.
and that took me a while to figure out who's habitually avoiding me.
Yeah.
And
so, who was it?
Well,
I'm just kidding. You don't have to say.
Yeah. So I blogged about it. I guess I can talk about it. So it was an old roommate who I think, we didn't stay friends after being roommates. And so I thought, I bet that person avoids me.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to friend them on Facebook, and then because I didn't know their phone number anymore, and then I thought the same thing you did. I won't feel the rejection. Mm-hmm. I won't know the moment they like saw that and decided, nah. So I also sent a message, because you can see when someone reads the messages.
Uh-huh.
And I saw the message. I sent the message, and I saw that like later he had read it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice, like, maybe we could just like be kosher friends again. This was not someone I was dating, by the way. It was literally just like a roommate. So
I know who it was.
So he obviously didn't respond. But what I was frustrated about later was that I think I could have written a more heartfelt message, but part of me kind of wanted to be rejected because I was supposed to be rejected. And then I felt a little bit guilty, like, why didn't I try to patch things up earlier? Probably because I was fearing being rejected. And then I just send this, like, kind of lame, like, hey, let's be buddies again. You know, it just felt like, I feel like I could have given a better pitch for why we should be buddies again, but then I wouldn't have maybe gotten rejected. So anyways,
sounds complicated.
Am I overthinking it just a little bit, do you think?
Well, yeah.
Should I just ditch this? Have I learned my lesson, or do I have to go through like 21 more days of this?
You do, but I think we should look for alternate lists of things to be rejected about. Our guest today is Bob Smith, Portland's favorite autodidact. He's designed with everyone from Nike to Wieden Kennedy. He's now with New Balance, and he's going to share some thoughts and inspiration, becoming a better designer, and thinking way outside the box. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Raymond. How are you?
I am excellent. Yourself?
Lovely.
Good.
This is a lovely little studio you have.
Yeah, here. Thank you.
Thanks for the beer.
Yeah, you bet. Stella, cheers. All right. So, why don't you tell me where you're from? Mm. Where were you born?
I was born in Hollywood, California.
Okay.
My dad moved us to Oregon when I was 10, against my will. We went from Malibu and Disneyland and Magic Mountain and all my friends in L.A. and Hollywood to Portland, Oregon in the early 70s.
Why? That was like a terrible time movie, wasn't it? That was like the worst time.
I'm still mad at him for it. Because he got a job. He grew up in L.A. and he'd had enough. And I had was just getting started. But he got a job with Tektronix.
Okay.
Which was kind of the Nike of his time.
Right.
So that kind of sets the stage for where I came from. That's I have, like, when I go back to California, even though I haven't lived there since I was 10, I go back down there and go, it just feels I feel like my people, even though they're messed up. And
it's like deep back in your, like, you know, lizard brain, right? There's like a California vibe.
Yeah, there's something about it. And I still remember, like, you know, running away from jellyfish at the beach and, you know, just like all that crap. You know, I think they say, like, what, the first 5 years of your life are like the most formative. And then anyway, so I lived there until I was 10.
Okay.
And then we moved up here. So that's where I was born.
Okay.
Where do we go with this?
What were you like in high school? Were you like the rock and roll guy?
I know, it's funny. I suspect everybody has this story, no matter how popular you were or think you were. I just never seemed to fit in. I wasn't nerdy enough to be nerdy. I wasn't cool enough to be cool. I did ascend. I was honored with class clown honors in my senior year. But okay. It's just, I never felt like I fit.
Yeah.
Do you know? Right?
I hated high school.
I know.
It was the worst.
I tell my kids now, because my son's going through high school now, and my daughter's in middle school, which we used to call junior high.
That's right.
But I said, just get used to it. It's the most miserable 3 years of your life.
Yeah,
just,
yeah. Your life sucks.
Just get through it. You're going to cry, and people won't understand you, and you might even, you know, might be violence. Who knows? But
wow, way to psych him up for that.
I know, right?
It's so true, though.
Well, I just want to manage their expectations, as they say.
Yeah, right.
So these poor kids.
Well, the problem with me was that high school was across the street from my house, so I missed.
I was that kid.
I lived right across the street from the house, so I like never went to school. I was terrible.
Those kids were so weird. It's not like living across the street from like the 7-Eleven, which would be really cool if you're that age, right?
No.
All the tank battle you could play, right? But anyway, so what where were we headed with that?
Did you play music?
I did. I played music. I played drums in bands, and then I started playing guitar about 10 years ago, just because I felt like I needed to. But I played in junior high and high school, and I played in jazz band and all that stuff. And I played in bands after I got out, and I always really loved it. And I was always I always thought it was curious that like all the people I went to school with who played music in band when you were in school, when they were done with school, that's when they stopped playing music. And I always thought that was really curious, like it was something they were being forced to do. And I was thinking, isn't this something you like doing?
Yeah.
Right? So,
it always seemed really weird to me that it was a thing in high school. If you know, like there was like jazz band, it was like, well, jazz is always like a foul word. Like, who wants to be in jazz band? Like,
and if you think about it, it wasn't even real jazz. It was like this weird kind of stage, stagey kind of. You weren't listening. You weren't playing Coltrane, for God's sake. You were playing
these big
band charts and stuff like that, which I loved. But it wasn't really. I remember when I first bought my first. I was supposed to buy this Weather Report record. And I thought, okay, cool. And I read it, you know, Downbeat. And it was like, wow, this is supposed to be really good. It got 5 stars and everyone's raving about
it. Like to practice for
no, just jazz to listen to it. I thought this is something. Because you realize I grew up in Tigard. So I went from like one of the hippest places in the world to like one of the stupidest places in the world. And I was like, so I was growing up in the burbs. And I thought, well, okay, I want me some of this, like, whatever this Weather Report. And I bought it, and I thought I had wasted my $4.44. And it was just, I didn't get, I was just like, what the hell is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, now it's like, it was, the record was Mr. Gone. Now it's like one of my favorite records of all time.
Yeah.
But it was just like one of those.
My dad is always listening to like, just like, you know, Beach Boys and classic rock. And I just fucking hated it back then. I was like, that's so. And now, of course, I'm like, can't stop talking about the fucking Beach Boys.
I know, right?
It's like, whoa.
Well, I know. It's like, it's funny. My dad, first, God bless him, he's still alive and he actually lives with us in our house. And he's the grandfather to my kids. It's awesome. But, he kept finding new ways to reinvent himself as a nerd. So like if he would have stayed with like the music he was listening to back then, he'd be like super cool now. But he found new ways to nerd himself out. Like, you know, after he got done with the Beach Boys, then he went on to Yanni. And then after he got done with Yanni, he went on to like, you know, who knows what else. You know, but like it's just like... But yeah, anyway, so that was my music thing with my family. It was like, it was everything. My mom was listening to pop radio in the car. I remember driving to the beach and hearing whatever was on the radio.
Yeah.
There was always just music. And then were you that kid who always had a song stuck in your head?
I still do. I get the same goddamn song in my head for like a week.
I know, right? It's awful. I mean, it can be great, right? I remember walking to school one morning. And, how old was I? I don't know. Getting that song Frankenstein stuck in my head.
No, it's that one.
You don't know that no. Edgar Winter song?
No, I don't know that at all.
Oh, it's this really heavy rock and roll song from the 70s.
Okay.
Anyone who's listening to this right now is going to go, yeah, I know that song, I know that song. But I just remember, I remember singing that song walking to school when I was like, God, how old was that? And I was just going, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And I was just like, I could play every note. You know, it's like, I was thinking, I love that song. That's... Thinking about it now, it's like that was like that same energy when I go see like a show now, when a band's really good, it comes from that same place in your gut where you just feel it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, looking back at it now, I realize that's kind of what was going on then. I still wish it said musician on my passport instead of designer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Cooler?
Yeah.
Designers don't get enough respect, do they?
I know. Well, and then lots of designers are now are playing music, and musicians are being designers. And right?
Yeah.
But I have a good friend. Do you know Alan Hunter?
I don't. Not by name.
RuPaul knows him.
Okay.
He's been on tour. He just got back with. He's a bass player in a band called The Eels.
You may
have heard of, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's been all over. And I got to play with him last summer and some little stuff here around town in Portland. It was really fun. And he got to go on tour, so I got to live vicariously through him.
Nice.
But, you know, I always feel like it was, like, that far away from hitting it. But,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and Portland.
You could have been in the Eagles with him.
Right?
No, just kidding.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
I know. And then, you know, the kooky, you know, crazy Courtney Taylor.
Yeah.
Yeah, was in a band called The Beauty Stab. Do you remember that? Were you here then?
No, was that before?
It was before.
Was that going?
It was before Neil's Rome.
Okay, I moved here in like...
Which was before.
I moved here in like 97.
Oh, okay, so you must... Okay, so that's, the dandies were in full swing at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yeah, he was a guy... I think, if I get my history right, he went to Sunset High School. I think Sunset or... And he won... His band in high school won Battle of the Bands. He's always been a really talented guy. He's an amazing songwriter. And he played drums in these bands for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did his own thing with the dandies. And of course... the rest is history of them. But there's, I think, the cool thing about Portland, as it's kind of come up, is that there's, like, you can do all of it. You really, like, you can do, you can have a podcast, you can play in a band, and you can design things. And it's like, I think any delineation you make is artificial.
Yeah.
You know? Because you can, I mean,
the town filled with, you know, Renaissance men and women.
I know, right?
It's very much like everyone.
I don't know. It just feels like the older I get, I feel like, well, why would I want to limit myself?
Well, that was the idea behind the show name, The Job. It's like, it's not really about, like, it's about how, like, you know, things go from hobby to job to hobby,
you know.
And especially in Portland, it seems like a lot of people are like, they were just really passionate about food, and then they
took
a stab at a restaurant, and oh my god, it like totally took off.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because spacing the guy's name, he had the Spy magazine, Kurt Anderson.
Okay.
Do you know who he is?
Yeah.
Wrote a book called Turn of the Century. Anyway, I saw him give a talk. He's a friend of Molly Hiltz, who's an artist here in town.
Okay.
And he gave a talk about a year and a half ago that totally like broke this thing wide open for me. And I'll have to jump back and explain what I'm talking about after I say what I'm going to say. Yeah, I'm not trained as an apparel designer. I'm not trained as anything, really. I didn't go to college very... I mean, I hardly have any... I'd be surprised if I have 10 credit hours to my name. But and I always had a job where I would do something, and then I would sort of scam my way into getting promoted and doing the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
So as I was telling you earlier before we started taping... I used to do displays like a Nordstrom and Myron Franks and Fred Meyer's window displays, dress mannequins and make signs and things like that. And then I kind of parlayed that into a job at Nike as a designer, as a graphic designer there. And I worked on apparel, and then I did that for 10 years. And during that time, I slowly kind of glommed my way into designing apparel pieces, because I was always working with really talented apparel designers, and I would sit in on fittings. Excuse me. I have to do this thing where, excuse me.
It's okay.
There it goes. Nice. Anyway, so like I was
always, we can edit that out. Don't worry.
I know. I always have these jobs, and I think, and I don't know. I think this is possible for anybody. You always have these opportunities to, if you're working in music, that leads to, you know, maybe a career in acting or whatever. Anyway, so this guy Kurt Anderson was talking about doing exactly that. He started out. As a writer, and he started publishing this magazine called Spy magazine, which was really big in the 90s.
Sure, I remember Spy. Yeah,
remember Spy?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So he was talking about this this career path where he did that, and someone asked him, "Hey, would you be interested in doing a radio show?" And he said, "Well, I've never done a radio show before, but it sounds like fun. I'll try it." Right. So he's not trained as a whatever, and that became this is where the facts. My source material kind of runs dry. I can't tell you what the name of the radio show was. But he was pretty successful at this. And then someone said, "Hey, do you want to do a TV show?" And he said, "Well, yeah." And I think that turned into, is it called 360 or something? I'll have to look it up. But anyway, that became successful. And his whole point was, I mean, the borders we put on what we do are self-imposed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And once he said that to me, and I was like, I thought, God, here's this guy I really respect and admire. By anyone's estimation, he's definitely successful, making it in New York. I thought, well, that was my permission to go full steam ahead with like this thing with doing apparel design for a small company at the time. But the guy I worked with and I were a good fit. And then we took that on the road. We went to New Balance. And now I'm designing tennis apparel for freaking the number 13 ranked tennis player in the world. I'm doing it for the Harvard men's and women's tennis teams, right? And dang, if it isn't good stuff and people are liking it, and I can do it.
Yeah.
So, no, you know, it's funny. Yeah. So, like I said, a lot of it is just like I think you're your own worst critic. And that can be helpful. I mean, that helps you from... putting crap out, right? Or
right.
Or being, you know, being like a, you know, like a dilettante, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think also it can prevent you from moving forward with something that might be a little scary.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Speaking of Dylan, I think that he experienced that same thing where he had a music career for decades and nobody ever really heard of him, and then he did this radio show or podcast, I think the Bob Dylan Radio Hour, and then everyone was like, "Oh, Bob Dylan," you know.
Yeah.
You know, just as an example.
Why wouldn't it work? I mean, think about it, right?
But I think that really, you know, when I talk to people like, you know, people who are going to work here or whatever, It's like, I, to me, and maybe I'm biased because I don't have any formal education either, but I feel like for someone to, like, you know, if someone's really passionate about it, that's worth so much more. It's priceless.
Oh my God.
You know, you'll figure it out. You know,
totally.
Yeah. Right. Especially something that's as new as web design.
You know what? I that's such a great point. I'm so glad you said that because I was thinking about this. When I was at Nike, I used to look at people's portfolios all the time. And they'd be going through school and I thought, that's good. But what I really want, let me back up just to have a space. There, we had basically designers fall into two camps. People who were trained as graphic designers and people who were fine artists who got work as graphic designers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me the people whose work I admired the most were always the fine artists. They had the most clever solutions. They had the best ideas.
Interesting. Yeah.
Rather than polishing your technique, you were like actually working on your source, like your intake, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the classes I did, one of the classes I do remember taking in college, I had this really great professor out at Mount Hood Community College, and he said, at the time I didn't know what to do, and he said, well, you might want to just go get a decent liberal arts education, and what that would do is that will increase your range of source materials so that you have more material to work with. And I thought about, as a designer, what I'm really doing is synthesizing, like, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, as we all know, right? There's different combinations of new ideas. And the more source material I felt like I had to draw from, the more original the possibility for solutions would be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other thing is, I thought school is just like a codified way of learning, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm, the whole time I wasn't going, I was missing out on, oh, maybe dorm life or interacting with other designers. But like, I mean, I don't know about you. I have a feeling I read voraciously, right? Do you do the same thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that's how you learn,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's how I learn.
I just have like a couple hours a night usually where I'm and you know, it's always, you know, and it really is a cross discipline. Like I might see like at some point I was obsessed with like the Swiss,
yeah,
like railroad clock face.
Yeah.
It's like right. Apple basically copped that idea for the iPad clock.
Yeah.
And I read that story and I was like, well, let me look at this clock. Why is it such a big deal that they paid a settlement or paid to license
it? Why is it so iconic?
And it's so good. I mean, it is like, it's just a clock face. I mean, it's just a bunch of little notches and I don't even think it has numbers on it, but it's just the balance of the elements is so nice,
isn't it? You know, it's it was Saul Bass's birthday yesterday.
Oh yeah,
and someone did a Google tribute. You know,
I saw that. Yeah,
see that? And it reminded me how much I love Saul Bass. And so much of that stuff is instinctual.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, you know, there are points. Like, I look back at stuff I used to draw, like when I was in high school, or even when I was. And they say you copy until you find your own voice, and then you know, it's all. But that goes back to what I was saying about synthesizing.
Yeah, yeah.
But like some of these people, like where they're drawing their source material, where it's coming from, is just like so intriguing. You know, Saul Bass is one of those guys where it's just everything he does is so primitive, and yet at the same time, it's so refined, right? It's so dialed in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the colors, the way he uses color and motion. And proportion and scale, you know. And I guess if I was classically trained as a designer, I could tell you, you know, there's probably like some probably rules that, you know, that are informed by all these things, right? They could say, there's that's proportion, that's, you know, whatever, the golden ratio. But have you ever, so the clock is a great example of that. There's something about it that even if you don't know anything about design,
mm-hmm.
you're, this sounds really corny, but you're kind of like your being kind of responds to it. Something about you catches your
eye. It's almost like it's when you glance at it, you can take in the information so quickly.
You don't
recognize the design.
Yeah.
You just look at it and instantly you can see the time. There's no,
which is what I love about once you actually. So what I like about it, and maybe you can relate to this too, is that because I'm kind of like I kind of backed into a career in graphic design or whatever you want to call it, design. It's fascinating for me to go back and read up on the history after I've already been at this for a while. Like I read a book, the history of Paul Renner, who's the guy who designed the Futura typeface.
Mm-hmm.
And back then he got like, I'm probably squishing this all into one big story, but like basically like he kind of got thrown into jail for like, you know, what he was designing, because design represented something that was kind of political at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine getting thrown in jail for doing a poster or a typeface now. It just seems, it's all style, right?
At the time, it was a little more. Yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because the whole Swiss thing, I believe, is all based on this idea of like this ultimate humanism, rationalism, right? Mm-hmm. Like making everything as clear as it could possibly be. And that was like the big, that was the goal of it all, right? So, you know, not that it was going to wind up in, you know, design within reach or it wasn't a style.
That
was
just a happy byproduct.
I know, right? But you know what I mean? It was like actually, there was like actually, which I think there's a nobler purpose attached to what they were doing at the time with design, right?
Yeah.
So, and which isn't to discount what people are doing nowadays, but I think there was an era, I think something about that period of time was more considered than it seems to be now. You know, the way people dress and the way people, you know, approach problem solving and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's definitely a larger question than I.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, I. You know, with Saul Bass and with even like Andy Warhol, it's funny how you look at his early work and how it evolved into the real. You know, for Saul Bass, it was like the movie titles and stuff, and for Warhol, it was the factory. You know how he turned that style into something where you can kind of still recognize a little bit of the elements of his.
Have you seen
early...
his shoes that he drew?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we use that as a reference on a site we did recently.
Oh my gosh. It's just like, and it all comes from a point. And my, so to me, not that you're going here, not to hijack the conversation, but it, to me, like, I think I love it because it all relates back to craft and wanting to do to skill, you know, and like, you know, it's like woodworking or carving or anything that people used to do before computers came along. Not that you can't do craft with computers, but like to me, like the idea of like of researching a topic and knowing it and working your craft and getting good at it, you know what I mean, is like really, really like that's what like, when I see someone who can really draw, because like, I still don't feel like I can kind of fuss my way into like, here, this is what I'm thinking, well, here, let me work. But some people are really good draftsmen, and that still blows me away.
Yeah.
So I'm not that. So anyway, that's what I respond to, like, especially with people like Warhol, where they go, oh, well, he just did these screen print paintings. Well, he came from a place that was very, like, where he practiced his skill and worked his craft, and his eye was, like, impeccable because he had that background of, you know, of drawing, you know.
And, like, while he may not have, like, actually done the screen printing with his hand at some point, it was like he was the aesthete, like he was the
right.
Yeah, he guided the know, like he was, you know, it was his name that was being put on things. So at some point he was like, you know, like Steve Jobs, he was just basically saying, yeah, this is good enough, this sucks, you know.
Yeah There's something to that where you have a point of view and it's editorial and you're not just trying to make something that everybody will like. You have something you're trying to communicate, and there's some people will like it and understand it, and other people will be offended by it, you know. So anyway, I feel like that's what I feel like I have space in my museum for Lady Gaga and Andy Warhol and Gerhard Richter and, you know, like anybody who's trying to do something with a voice and working at their craft. I think there's space for it. But wow, how's that for broad?
No, that's great. You know, talking about what you were talking about with school, I see that too, because I didn't go to college or anything like that. So I always felt like, you know, like, and maybe this is only at like, you know, Ivy League schools, but it's like, you know, half of the point of going there was to make connections and stuff.
Right.
Hopefully by now my connections came from working in coffee shops or whatever.
Right.
I know. Hopefully
and that's
they're
valid.
There. Yeah.
How is that not valid?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, they're not, you know, East Coast.
Yeah. Are you from the East Coast or what?
No. I'm basically grew up in the Twin Cities.
So. Yeah. Oh, wow. Wow. That explains the Rupel and you connection.
Perhaps. Yeah. I mean, I don't know her from there, but we.
I know, but it's the same. Aesthetically, people are from. My wife is from Akron.
Oh, okay.
Some of my favorite people.
Well, I'm originally from Cleveland.
So. Oh, perfect. 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 That's why I like you guys then. Something really practical about you guys. But I got to tell you, speaking of that Harvard thing, it's really. It's been blowing my mind because I grew up on the West Coast. I'm working with New Balance and they're in Boston. And all the traveling I did for Nike, I never went to New England. Mm-hmm. And it's always been, as an American culture, it's so of itself. And it's always really intriguing to me. So to be going there and the first time I went to Harvard, there really is like an energy to that. That just, especially, like I said, with no college education, growing up on the West Coast, you go to Harvard and you're just like, oh my God, this is it. This is where like freaking Roosevelt went to college.
Now, yeah.
You know, where, I mean, like, and I got a tour of the campus, and there's like, wow, this place is older than the United States. There's some history there. So for right. a kid with no rules, going to some place like that and working with them, it's just kind of like taking everything I know about what's normal and just kind of stood on its head, right? So, and it's, I think, like, it's just like your culture. It's a cultural thing, right? Coffee shops are as valid a culture thing. A band is as valid a culture thing as Hartford is. It's just a different, you know.
It's true, yeah.
So, it's funny. It took me a long time, Raymond, to get over my insecurity about not going to college. You know what I mean?
Because, yeah.
Like, some people, you know, it's just a different path, you
know? Yeah.
So, proud of it, but I think I'm a lot more accepting of myself now. You know, where I feel like, oh, it's just a fuck up. I could never make school work. It just wasn't a good fit. You know, and it's maybe not a good fit for, especially what we do.
Yeah,
it's what you know, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't. You know, that's the thing. You know, if I had thought, oh, I'll be a web designer.
Right.
Well, that would have been impossible when I.
Right.
You know, at my age, it just was that didn't exist. The web literally didn't exist when I would have been going to college. So, you know what?
Yeah.
I guess I could have studied design. But
well, who knows, though? But yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what I wanted to do when I was in high school. I wanted to play in bands, and I liked designing things. I didn't see how that either one of those could really be a realistic career. But
I guess more to the point is that I don't feel like. I feel like I have to learn something new, like, every damn week.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or every other week. It's like, well, guess what? The business is growing. I got to learn how to sell.
Right.
I got to, like, learn how to be a salesperson and shit like that.
Right.
I would never have studied in the 90s.
You know, it's so funny you said that, because I was thinking, I was just at this big, giant sales meeting, giant for New Balance anyway, last 2 weeks ago. And I've been working on this line all here for the last year. It's finally getting ready to come out to market. And I thought, oh, I have to present to all these salespeople, and they want to know what the story is. And the better I do my job of telling them what the story is, the easier their job will be selling it, which will, in turn, of course, that's good for me, because if it sells, then I'm successful as a designer, blah, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. And I started thinking, and I saw some people get out there and try to sell their work, and they weren't always designers. Sometimes, like, the line manager would present it. I always thought the designer was the best person, if they were qualified and were good at it, to sell, because obviously the inspiration comes from the designer, blah, blah, blah. But I just felt so sorry for some of these people who couldn't articulate their vision, and they got all caught up in reading the PowerPoint slides and all this stuff, and it was like, it felt to me like, well, as a designer, you kind of have to do two things. You have to be a good designer, but then you also have to be good at selling.
Right.
And that's as important.
Even if you're just like,
right.
Even if that's not your job.
And it occurred to me that there's always been, and there always will be, like this artist patron relationship, no matter what. It can be really overt, like if on Etsy, or if you're a fine artist and you're gonna have a gallery showing, or it can be as me as a apparel or product designer. There's a certain point where you take your work that you've done and you hold it up to somebody else who's writing the check or buying it or selling it, and you say, what do you think, right? And they can either thumbs up or thumbs down, but there's never not that and
right. sometimes there's always right? some degree of like
right?
pitching or selling or right. like like have you ever do you know who Mike Montero is or he wrote this a very slender volume called Design as a Job and his point was just a big part of the point of the book is that like you have to defend your design.
Yes.
Like, you can't, like, too many designers, and he's talking about the web, but really it applies to anything. Like, we'll make a design and then just kind of expect someone else in the business
right.
to pitch it to the client.
Right.
And then they come back with a bunch of stuff, and it's like, well, this is bullshit. I can't do this.
Right.
You know, like, you need to be facing the client and saying, no, I can't change this. There's a reason for this.
I agree. That's why I think Mad Men is so fascinating.
Oh, me too.
I mean, because you see, like, the different, how that works, for better or worse.
I would love to just see a mashup of all of just the pitch meetings.
Pitches, right?
And not any of the fucking drama. Just, like right? 5-10 minutes of each episode.
Totally.
If someone would make that for me, I would pay more for that.
No
because
shit,
I don't.
Right?
I just don't have the patience
so
for that.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I was thinking at Nike. I mean, like, I guess in a really real way, Nike was kind of my educator, like, real,
Your college.
My college. And I saw some people who were really good at talking and telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at their designs, I go, well, they're okay.
Mm-hmm.
But they always had, like, this heat. You know, they always had people really are into them, what they did. And I realized, like, yes, please. It occurred to me, like, oh, they're just really good at selling. And
yeah,
it's,
like, even,
right?
Yeah.
It's really, I mean, and not, I'm not saying that's all it was, but that was a large, that was my big takeaway from that. I was like, wow, so if, and I, so I have all these personal maxims that I'm going to write down in a book someday and no one's going to care about it, but like, but I remember, you know, those, you kind of think to yourself, and then you write it down in your head. And I remember thinking, it is what I say it is, right? To a large degree. To a larger degree than I think most people realize it. Like, if I think it's good and I really believe in it, then it is, right? And it's up to, and it's, you know what I mean?
Well, I learned from watching other designers pitch that they don't, like...
You can tell them they don't
believe
instance,
it, right? there's a really the basic idea that you don't just let someone walk in the room and just see the damn design. Like, there's a whole sort of...
Right.
Ceremony there in a way to sort of reveal it and tell the story and walk them through the story. And like, I feel like a junior designer, someone who's new, that's like you're giving a presentation and it's a really intricate thing with lots of moving parts that are a lot of psychology. And it's like that. I don't know how you'd even teach that in school.
It's funny. I think about this all the time. I used to read like a ton of like how to play drum books, and which is fine, and lots of how to design books, but I still do. But I realized at a certain point, you just have to do the work.
Yeah.
And I have like,
I gotta beat the drum.
I have all these anecdotes about like all these, you know, any subject you care to discuss. But one of my favorite ones is actually about this. It was like, I remember seeing or reading something about like the Disney studio back in the 50s.
Yeah.
When people would get a job there. I think that's what turned into Art Center. Or not Art Center, the Cal Arts.
Oh, sure.
So anyway, and one of the illustration professors said, he goes, when you got here, okay, your first day here, you probably have about 10,000 bad drawings in you, and I'm here to get them all out of you, right? I'm here to get rid of those 10,000 bad drawings. And the idea is just doing it. And some people have a gift, and they'll get there quicker, but what I've noticed... the time I spent at that other place and the time even like I gave like 6 presentations last week is just like you just get through it and you get better at it and you practice and that's how you, I mean, just, you know, just putting in the work is how you get better at that.
That really reminds me of that, I don't know if you've ever read the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell.
No, I haven't.
That popularized this idea that it takes 10,000 hours to get good at anything, like whether it's, you know, and he theorized that if you added it up, that the Beatles spent 10,000 hours
in
before,
Hamburg, where were
before even being recorded. Which,
right?
You know, it's probably true because they would play like for ten hours at a time.
Right.
You know, and like if you look at any great artist, you just think like, oh my gosh, they were just born perfectly. They came out of this eggshell with this magic, but.
You know, the annoying thing is there are those kids in junior high school.
There are, yeah.
Who drew the perfect Van Halen logo on their PC, right? It's like, God damn it.
Yeah, your backpack looks great.
I know, right? The V is so perfect. And that S in Santana is so... Oh, my God. Right? So there are those, right? But, like, you know, like one of my favorite quotes these days is hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard.
Hmm.
And the reason I say that is I was in all those crazy gifted programs in L.A. when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know what it does to you, but I'm guessing it probably fucked me up pretty bad.
Yeah.
I got thinking, like, well, I'm gifted, right?
Yeah.
So I don't have to, like... And then, meanwhile, like, you're like, and so you're kind of taking it easy, and you see these other kids get A's, and I was thinking to myself, well, if I really tried, I could, but I don't want to try, blah, 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 blah. Right? Well,
right.
And I had to learn as an adult, then, how to discipline myself to do the work that I knew I was capable of.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that... My big thing nowadays, and this is... when I'm trying to teach my kids, God help me, is that just showing up and doing the work every day is so huge. And I think it's underrated, or it is to me anyway. It has been for a long time. Just showing up, putting in the hours every day and being there.
Yeah.
You know, because, and I think that's when I do that, that's how I realize I'm the most successful, you know.
I guess that touches on the other reason why this show is named The Job,
the
is because
job,
it's
right?
it's very much it like is. you have to show up and you have to do the work, and like sometimes you'll have to try the same thing like 100 times before it works.
I still have to do schematics. I'm like, I've been doing this for like 15 years. I still have to do button schematics. Yeah, because if I don't either, if I don't, then I give the power to somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or if I don't, set up a way to have it. You know what I mean? Like, I have to put in the work some way or another, right? I either have to do the work or set it up so somebody else can. You know what I mean?
Well, it's like the whole, like, the Warhol factory or anything like that. It's like ultimately the responsibility falls to the person whose name is attached to it. And if you know, abdicate that responsibility, just, you know,
like your presentation example, right?
Yeah.
Presenting, like, if I give it to somebody else to present, then I've given my part of my power away.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And they're going to make you look like an asshole. You don't.
I know. Well, you know, I've seen people, like, where they take your work and they objectify it. They go, well, the designer was thinking, and they take, they're one step away from it, so they've insulated themselves against it being good or bad, right? So they don't have any skin in the game. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, so, whereas if the person was involved in the process, then they would defend it more as here's what we were thinking, this is what, rather than, you know what I mean, that arm's length thing. So I think, as a designer, I think, first of all, I have to know I'm doing good work, right? But the other thing is, I have to, like, care about what I'm doing and be interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I'm not, any one of those things can kind of torpedo my effort, right?
Right.
I mean, there's nothing worse than working on something that you don't believe in.
Well,
you know,
you'll never do a good job.
Which is different than not feeling like designing that day, right?
Sure.
If you're working on a project, if I was supposed to, you know, design something for something I didn't care about, wasn't interested in, or, you know, like, then, like, I probably won't, you know, give my best effort. Right, especially if I don't believe in it.
Right,
right. But the fun thing about working at if I can do this for a second, the fun thing about Nike, where I found a good place for myself, and the fun thing about being at New Balance now is that they actually, if you dig deep enough, there's a really good story there to tell, and that's what gets me excited. And then when I get excited, I want to. It's kind of like when you have, like, a in your neighborhood, if you think about growing up, like, oh, I got this really cool thing, come check this out, right? A cool magazine or something like that, and you get people fired up and involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're excited, then other people get excited, and then they
right
kind of, then
yeah,
and then you have people who are excited about their work.
No, stories are really a huge, powerful thing in human nature, and
yeah.
You know, I always think, like, if you lose a passion for something you're doing, then, like, some young gun who's passionate,
right,
regardless of their education, is just going to, they're just out of attrition or just time eventually,
just
that
someone,
you can't hold up to it because
they're
going to be, like, burning the midnight oil, like, fascinated by this thing and, you know, just learning everything and just soaking it up, and you're just going to be like,
like, you did, right? Like, I did. Like, I've done it before. Like, we're just like, oh, my God, you're clicking through it, or you're reading something, and you've got stacks and stacks. You're reading the Paul Renner book, or they're reading the, you know, this, you know, the, you know, the story of Swiss modern design or any of that stuff. Are they really into it?
Mm-hmm.
I have this thing. I have one of my, another one of those maxims I have, personal maxims I have with the people I work with.
Mm-hmm.
And, now is like, if we're working on a product, if, you know, working on a shirt or a dress or a skirt or a coat or a jacket or something like that, and if we get the samples back, and if you don't, I tell them, if you don't want to steal it, then we probably shouldn't be making it. You know, like, if you don't, if it's not good enough for you to want to take home, then why are we even wasting time making it?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It's like, so let's just drop it right now, right? And focus our energy on stuff that we do want to do.
Right.
Right. But I remember working at Nike. We'd have these line plans that are like 14, 20 items wide, right? Okay, we need this. We need this. We need this. And because we had this last year, and we did this 2 years ago, and this sold really well 3 years ago, and like, and then you get this line, and like, There was just. I mean, you only had a couple people working on it, maybe, and it was like an inch deep and like a mile wide. And it was like, who needs that?
Yeah,
who wants that anymore? And what's kind of fun now to see, like, the tide is kind of shifting back in general towards more crap made and crafted. You see, I'm a Gene and Willie in Nashville. They're making handmade jeans one at a time for people.
Yeah.
That's part of what's fun about working at New Balance. Not to pitch the company I'm working for, but they make, I think it's 25% of their production still made in the United States.
Okay.
It's like they're actually still, it's kind of an archaic business model, but there's something about it that feels like you're supporting something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And it means something. And believe me, I'm not knocking Nike, because I learned a lot of great things there, and they're making some really amazing products. But like, I just felt like it was kind of fun to take a step back and do something that was a lot personally more purposeful and you know, and impactful in that way, right? And I think you've seen that shift Certainly here in Portland, you know, like how many people are hand roasting coffees and making beers. And and the work that you know who I love is these guys. I keep wanting to call them Oh My Fucking God Company, the original manufacturing company.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Jeremy
they're great.
And Fritz.
Yeah, yeah.
They make that shit by hand.
Yeah,
have you been in that bar?
Yeah,
they
totally.
Made their own goddamn Papa Shot.
Yeah,
who, that was talk about uncalled for.
Yeah, no, they're awesome. That's, you know? I got to get those guys on here too.
Yeah, oh my God, they're great. Sure. Yeah. So yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I'm talking about. I think like I thank God. I mean, it's the pendulum is kind of swinging back the other way. Because I just...
Sometimes it's hard to tell, and maybe you can answer to this more because you travel more than I do, but sometimes I worry that I'm in a bubble here in Portland and that, like, no one else in, you know, Kansas gives a shit.
Oh,
you know, or,
yeah.
Maybe it is.
Well,
maybe
I don't travel to Kansas at all.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
I can't tell you much about that.
But in New York City, though, I guess.
Yeah, no, but you know what? I'm in London, I'm seeing it.
Yeah.
And certainly in Boston.
Yeah.
My sense is if you're autodidactic as I am, I think you have your finger on a lot of pulses that you're on the net. You feel it. I think it feels like, and again, this is anecdotal, so I don't have my source material locked down with this, but it feels like it's heading that way.
We'll get our researcher on
that. And here's one of the things I cite. Like, the Olympics last year, was it last year or 2 years ago, where Ralph Lauren made all the opening and closing ceremony stuff.
Right.
And it was, as most apparel is, it was manufactured in Asia, China, Vietnam, wherever. And people were so upset that the American, you know, all the American uniforms were made overseas. I'm like, but the fact is that's kind of the standard practice, right? And it's really unusual for things to be made here in the United States.
Right.
The reason I bring that up is what that told me is that was kind of like that was kind of a shot over the bow of business as usual, or as you know, the status quo. And that said to me, like, that means someone like Ralph Lauren is now going to start focusing their resources on manufacturing domestically. You have people like, and I started thinking about, you know, again, like, this is all anecdotal. Like, you have American Apparel has this big Made in USA thing, even though Dove's.
That's kind of their thing. That's
right?
Part of their brand.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you see more and more, I do anyway, especially in the line of work I'm in.
Yeah.
Like you see more and more and more of it. There's Herschel, you know, backpack people. You have Filson up in Seattle. You have Tanner Goods here in town. I mean, it's just there's enough of these little places. And for the first time, it's like actually considered, you know, it used to be like Made in Germany was great, or Made in USA actually means quality.
Yeah.
Which is kind of bizarre,
you know,
growing up when we did, right? Like, right?
So, yeah, it's true.
That's kind of where I'm getting my readings from. I think it is coming back here. It's coming back here.
I think you're right. I mean, even the, you know, and this is to go outside of apparel, that even the CEO of Apple recently said they were going to start making one of their computer lines, which.
Yep.
I mean, when Apple first started,
they made their computers here.
And then, you know, over time, it's like you just couldn't compete on that when everyone else in the industry everyone else was just dominating you. And pretty soon it's like standard. You assume it's not made here. Why would you think otherwise?
Right.
But it is exciting to think that there's.
Well, it's interesting. It's just an interesting turn of events. That to me speaks to like people are interested in. And I don't know if this is me getting older. I'd be curious to see what my kids think. But like, I feel like rather than having more stuff, having fewer pieces, but better pieces of stuff, you know, things that'll last longer. You buy more venerable things, and like, you know, the other thing. So that's the pull. The push is on the other side of it. You have like the result of investing in like this fast fashion thing, right? Like the Bangladesh factory a couple of weeks ago collapsing,
right.
and it's just like people are starting to realize that these choices actually do have consequences, right? So it's interesting. People, I don't know. Now, this is definitely a first world problem, right? I mean, like, wow, well, I don't want to buy my $100, $150 shirt at Target. I want to buy it at, you know, like, you know, meanwhile, you know, some people don't have cell phones or clean water or, you know, whatever. It's I always go here, sorry. You know, I was going, I always go big picture, but as a designer, anyway, I think what I'm encouraged by is I feel like it's getting back to craft. And the service of a story rather than just style. I mean, I think style will always be there, But do you know who Stefan Sagmeister is?
Yes.
Yeah. I remember seeing a conference of him when I was just like a Cub designer like 10 or 15 years ago. And his thing at the time was style equals fart. You know, and I think the corollary was, you know, substance equals art, right? The idea is like anybody can paste a style on anything and send it up there and make it a, you know, make it look good. But he wanted to work on things that actually had a purpose, which is like, wow. I mean, who doesn't want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to sit around? I mean, who just wants to sit around and crank out like the latest font of the day?
It's really appealing for a designer when you feel like so much of what you're doing is so removed from.
Yeah.
I mean, you just feel like you're giving marching orders and then like someone in Asia follows them.
Right,
or whatever. It's appealing to think of that whole process being a little closer in or that affecting people more directly.
You know what, you're probably very well qualified to talk about this. You work with Dwayne, right, at Stumptown.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always been about, like, those restaurants he opens now are beautiful, and that really speaks to his eye and his care that was always there from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What was that like working with him?
Well, I think that, and we actually did an interview with him, not for this, but before that, but, you know, he's really, you know, it's nice with restaurants because people can be more directly rewarded by locally sourcing. You know, like when he had those amazing oysters in Woodsman.
Yeah.
Like he has those relationships. He goes to the coast and meets with them and stuff. And and definitely, like, you know, like all the lighting in like Ava Jeans, which is amazing. I think that's all from Schoolhouse Electric. I think they do that in Portland. I think it's amazing how much of that you can do locally now, you know? And it's really exciting that, you know, someone could be rewarded by, you know, I mean, that's a great business model. I just love that.
Don't you?
Yeah.
I was just
restaurants
about that.
In Portland are just one of the most
I made a choice when I started working at New Balance because I knew it would be all consuming, and it has been.
Mm-hmm.
But I was starting to do a lot of print design for restaurants, and the wine label I gave you, and the bottle, and you know, I did the stuff for Tabla. And I mean, there's some really great people in town to do work for, and they really appreciate great work, and they're really great partners. And I was sad to kind of have to leave that behind.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I
mean? Were you doing like that sort of like freelance work before?
Who knows? I saw Jeremy Pelly about a month ago down at the Ace in Palm Springs.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm onto my fifth career now. I don't know what the
Yeah, because like
on.
Every time I go in a cheese bar or even Tabla, I see your work there on like those posters for the Munger versus Munger.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, that goes back to what I was saying about just developing an eye for quality, right? Because I've always loved clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've always worked with clothes. Even when I was at Nike, I designed graphics and stories that went on clothes or with clothes.
Mm-hmm.
That whole Nike sportswear thing, I started there. So that came from like a storytelling perspective that wasn't being told at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So
wait, what was that? What do you?
Oh, so the Nike sportswear logo that you see everywhere now, right?
Okay.
I drew that by hand.
Okay.
And that came from, it's been a while now. I keep thinking it was like last year, but it's actually been about 10 years. Nike was very well established as a performance apparel company, but they weren't very good, in my opinion, at the time of doing like what I would call like classic streetwear or sportswear, right? Which is like stuff that you'd see like in a shop, like down at like a compound gallery right? They didn't do that very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they could have been, and other people were doing it. And I thought Nike was taking themselves too seriously what they call it. They call themselves authentic athletic, and they only made things that you could actually work out in.
Right.
But that left a lot of stories on the table, specifically the UVO track team. Steve Prefontaine, Phil Knight's story, Bill Bowerman's story, all the people that went along. I mean, it was a really amazing story because I think about it. It was like the confluence of Bill Bowerman, Steve Prefontaine, Phil Knight, and Jeff Hollister all coming together at the same time to create what they created was really unbelievable. And it was actually kind of born out of this 60s reaction to like the establishment. Ironically, they were reacting against Adidas and I think they're kind of the same thing.
right.
But anyway, what I wanted to do was tell a story with the apparel that told that captured all that, and they weren't doing it. And so I put together a line. I just I used my God, I don't even know how deep I should go with this, but anyway, I yeah,
go crazy.
I put that together and presented it to some senior management, and they said, yeah, this is a good idea. Let's go do that. And that little Nike Sportswear logo is what I drew to kind of like. I went down to Melrose one time, and I went through all these thrift stores, and they all had it said, you know, Nike blue label, orange label, and orange label was the very first hang tag they ever put in the back of any of their clothing, and it said Nike Sportswear, and I thought, that's weird. We don't use that anymore, and we hadn't used it since 1970 something. Mm-hmm. They dropped it. Hmm. And I thought, well, that's what we should call it. And so I took the Nike logo and I kind of fucked it up a little bit. And if you pull them up next to each other, you can realize like it's kind of tweaked and kind of weird and mm-hmm. wrong. And they hung and they kept using it. It started out as like this teeny little logo for this teeny little collection, and they kept using it. And now it's everywhere. So anyway, the reason I bring that up is because that means I was onto something, right? That means that means it was a story that actually had we're telling that resonated with people.
It had legs.
You know, I was actually just in London a couple weeks ago, and I had to talk to the guy that I worked with there in a number of years, and I told him about where that came from, and he said, oh, yeah, everybody here knows where it came from.
Is it the all caps one?
Yeah, but okay. It's not the all feature one.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
The sportswear I drew, the sportswear typeface itself is hand-drawn. It was based on... I started out using Universe Condensed. Mm-hmm. It didn't look quite right. Mm-hmm. And I tried a couple different, you know, like I tried Trey Gothic. Nothing looked quite right. And so I thought, well, I'll just draw it myself.
Okay.
Right? And I was actually literally using like these wonky old woven hang tags from like 1978, 1979, and just trying to replicate that feel.
Yeah, interesting.
And it was so funny. Like now, like you probably get this question all the time. Like a designer will call you up and they want to like use something that you did. And they said, what font is that?
Yeah.
And like, well... It's not really a font.
Or we'll just yeah. guess the font.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Do you know who Jessica Heesh is?
Sure.
She was like, I saw her talk a couple years ago, and I love the fact that she was just like, if it didn't exist, she would make it up. And I love the idea of like, you know, just because I can't find it in a font or a box or a clip art thing, I'll just go make it.
Yeah.
Because it needs to exist.
Yeah.
And that really resonated. She was another person that just pushed me over the edge that way. It's just like, when I heard her say that, I was just like, of course, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because what we really want is the best solution, right? Not the best solution I can get out of a font package.
Exactly.
The best solution, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's sometimes you forget that when you're designing and you have like, you know, you have your Dropbox and your hard drives and gigabytes and gigabytes of source material. Yeah. It's like, we just need a bag. Needs a square and a circle or it's like sometimes you just got to roll up your sleeves and like, that's a great story. Like sometimes, like the fact that you drew that sort of thing that was a little bit different than the thing already out there, it's like almost subconsciously, I feel like sometimes I worry that design is something that it's hard to pitch to a man on the street. Like, what's so great about design? Sometimes I feel like you could demonstrate it to them and they would get it.
Do you always walk around with that feeling in your head?
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I think, like, just give me 5 minutes, I can show you exactly why it is.
Yeah.
I always feel like just that confidence.
Yeah. I do. I really do. I feel like if sometimes, you know, like we work with clients who are. I mean, we have clients all over the world, and it's really hard sometimes because you just want to sit down and say, let's pull up this website. Let's watch it load. Let's click through it and experience it together.
Right.
And then this one and see what you think.
What do you think, right?
Yeah, I feel like I could spend all day trying to write an email that would explain the subtleties of this or that, but... Go on.
I just so this is again this is fun to talk to you because I think we realize that we've taken in information a lot of the same ways. I saw Steve Sandstrom talk at one of these. I think the AIGA has been doing those things at the laundry down at the A's.
Yes.
They've been really good, and I try to go whenever I can. I
saw at the A's, you mean?
Yep.
Yeah.
The Ace Laundry. Mm-hmm. He said he's so good. He's so good. I forgot how good he was. He was saying he had this really great slide that says people don't care how clever your solution. People don't care how clever your solutions are. They want to know that you care about them.
Yeah.
That you care about.
That's a great quote. Yeah.
I mean, isn't it? It's like, oh my God, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
Think about like when you're arguing with your wife about the dishes. It's not about the dishes.
No.
Shouldn't be about the dishes. It's that you never pay attention to her.
Right, right, right.
Or, you know, like, it's not about the dishes.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, if a client knows that you care about their brand,
right.
then they trust
and they're
that
engaged,
what you're,
right?
Yeah.
And they're engaged.
Yeah. They trust that you're like going to be a good shepherd
right.
under the internet or something.
Right.
Whereas, if they feel like you don't get it, which is right. a challenge when you're working with someone,
or if you're being flippant about their needs, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because one of the things that when I was talking to Jeremy last month, he goes, "Sometimes we just, you know, we have to make sure that people we're working with get it too."
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is a great.
Sometimes
point.
It's not a good fit.
Yeah.
It's just not a good fit. It's funny. I told my son a couple of years ago. Said I had to fire a client. He goes. You had to fire a client, or did they fire you? I said, no, it wasn't a good fit. I told them it wasn't a good fit.
Yeah.
You know, because like, you know how those things go, right?
Yeah.
You keep trying to make it work, and they don't get it, and they want you to revise it, and they don't understand what your time's worth, and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And you know it, because you've done it before, and it's happened to you before, and it has to be a good fit.
Yeah.
So, that's why I think it's interesting, like, when you see people, now I know it's true, and you know it's true, too, when you see designers, and they get an award for something, and they say, and I always seem it sounded kind of phony when I first heard it. It's like, well, we have a great client that we work with. And now I understand a little better what they're talking about, because I've had a few of them, and you realize, like, they trust you. And hopefully you've had this happen to you, where you have a solution you've given to a client, and you really stridently believe in it, and you present it with all your heart and soul, and they don't get it. And they come back to you the next day, and they said, I've had this happen a couple of times, and they said, you know, when I went to bed, I didn't like it. When I woke up in the morning, I looked at it. I loved it. Have you ever had that happen?
I've had a similar thing happen.
Yeah.
Maybe never quite that amazing.
Well, I might be overselling my position, but like, it's like sometimes it just takes...
Yeah.
Has to sink in it, and you're stretching them, hopefully, in a way that they, you know, which means you're onto something that's original and memorable, which is the point, right?
Yeah. You know, and I've looked at designs that I've done... In retrospect, and I have certainly looked at them and said, you know what, I was going the wrong way, and you know, the client did. Because, you know, really, I'm not doing what I do. I'm not an artist. I'm a designer. You know?
Yeah,
I'm
right. You're an arranger.
A curator. Like, I'm delivering something that's going to help their business.
Yeah.
And if it helps mine, great.
Yeah.
But really, yeah.
You're after, like, it's funny, because... And I'm not always... In fact, I'm pretty sure I suck at this, but you're after the right solution. Not, you know...
Yeah.
You don't have to be right. You just want the right solution, the best solution, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that is with you. Maybe that is... Maybe it's, you know, there's somebody that may be better at executing that.
Sure, sure.
Who can say?
But, that's definitely been the case.
You know, I mean, think about people who are really, really stylized. And, I mean, like, and like, they're different, like, maybe... And going back to you know, to music, you wouldn't hire... Dave Grohl to play on your symphony record,
right?
You know, and he wouldn't play Vic Firth to play on your Queens of the Stone Age record.
I've always tried to, as a, you know, agency wise, tried to fight against having a certain sort of house style or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, you do, you always do.
Yeah.
Like, there's always, just in the jobs that you accept or the types of clients you work with, or just the, whether you're thinking about it or not, it's going to come out.
How I'm curious, how does that go for you? Is it, especially because I've always worked on my own. Mm-hmm. How does that work for you when a client comes across the desk for you? What's your process?
A website?
No, I mean, I know you have your questionnaire. Mm-hmm. How do you decide if it's a good fit?
Mm. You know, sometimes you're not sure and you just want to challenge yourself and see if you can do something that's a little outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
But definitely there's, you know, a client will have an existing website and hearing them describe what's bothering them about that or why it isn't working is the most helpful thing in the world.
Oh, no kidding, right?
Because right. If they have a website and I think, it's not bad, and then they say, well, my problems are this, and they're really insightful and they're really well considered.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, listening to someone who's really thinking things through and working with that kind of person is delightful. Working with someone who's a little too prescriptive and heavy-handed you know, like if they're describing problems with their site as like, this isn't working or this isn't working or it just doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
I can deal with that, but if they're like, well, this is red, it should be blue, and giving those kinds of things, then I feel like it's not going to be a good fit. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I assume that someone has looked at our portfolio and they know what our style is and what we're going for.
Right, right. I would think,
they're not going to come to us if like they want something that's totally not what we do. You know,
What? I got to say, I hardly ever, when someone, like the poster is up in Steve's place, and I hope he's not listening to this, because will someone leave their phone number? Because I've done this a couple times. Like, they'll go, oh, I really like what you did. Can you call me? I hardly ever call back.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, you know what? I just like, I don't know.
Well, the worry there is that they're going to want you to do the same thing.
Thing,
wow, that's not appealing.
It's just like, So...
Well, in any way, you've kind of you're doing other things. I mean,
Well, there's that too.
Yeah,
there's that too. But
yeah,
I always like to think that the work I do at this point is pretty much self-segmenting, right?
Yeah,
no one's going to come and ask me to do like
right. And, I mean, we've tried various things to get clients, like running Google Ads or cold calling at various points in our history, and that has never worked.
And does it? Right, I know
it's
right.
It's just the results that you get are people who have their, you know, we are like several orders of magnitude out of their ballpark or something. You know, it's just like they have no, like they clicked on a Google ad. They're not looking for a 5-figure website or something. You They're not looking for that.
The guy I'm working with right now, who I love dearly, he's the guy who used to run tennis at Nike, ironically. Now we're like, him and I like to say, what we're doing with the tennis apparel at New Balance is we're trying to create a pull, not a push. So I don't want to I don't want to jam this into any place. Mm-hmm. I want to create something that people want to come get.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
You want to create an attraction, right? Like where like you see like and when I think about a place here in town that makes me think of that, it's like I think about Blake or Lizard Lounge, someplace where you go like there's going to be something new and interesting and I'm attracted to that, right? Not
I love what Lizard Lounge is doing. I love that place.
Right? I mean, that's the whole thing. The vibe and the guy who runs the place is awesome.
Yeah.
And it's just always something. It's really interestingly curated and displayed and stuff. Yep. And that's like you're drawn to it, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than like, oh shit, I need toilet paper. And I know it's half off or for my
right.
That's a whole different proposition.
Yeah.
So and again, I mean, not to put too fine a point out, but so much of that is storytelling. It's something that's interesting that you're drawn to. There's a point of view, and you're doing something that's interesting.
Yeah, you learn a lot of stuff about. I mean, when we started out, I remember reading a book by Guy Kawasaki.
I love Guy Kawasaki.
Yeah, he was. It love was Guy his Kawasaki. First book after I think he left Apple, and he was always harping on you need to position yourself at the high end. You always want to be the person who's like, you know what? I understand that you might not be able to afford us, but if you can, here's what we'd love to deliver. You know, you always want to be in. It's like. It's just, worth being that person. You a lot of...
I was talking to somebody, they called me up, and they said, hey, there's so-and-so, I was going to do some work for them, and I told them this is what I would charge them. And I said, oh my God, you're screwed. Because you told them, you should actually be charging twice that, and now you can't go back and tell them that.
Yeah.
You already told them you're going to work for like half of what you should have.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
Right.
It's that thing. It's like, I always be coming at it like what's this worth? You know, and the man of a million anecdotes, but I remember seeing Charles Anderson, and he said, I think that he said a trap a lot of designers fall into is that they think they're selling a service. And they're really selling a commodity. You're selling something. You're selling a brand. You're selling an idea. You're not just selling typesetting. You're not just selling coloring. You're selling, here's an idea, and it's worth something bigger than just the hours it took to do it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And absolutely.
That's none of those things that's always stuck with me. It's like, God, I mean, if nothing else, that Nike sportswear thing, holy shit.
Yeah.
That is like, that they've been using that logo for, I mean, ever since I did it, 10 years ago.
Yeah, a big fear is that people will look at us and think, how many hours is it going to take?
I know because that, and that's a really good, that's a red flag. It's like, if that's what you think you're getting. Not that you're going to screw them.
Right.
But if that's what you're thinking right off the bat, then that's not a good sign.
Right. That's not
a good sign.
Yeah. Right?
So, but anyway, I think, I think if it's, I did all that work for Pendleton.
Yeah.
I was like, God, so I feel like I'm contributing to like this canon of, you know, great design and, you know, venerable design. People hold on to those blankets for like,
sure,
you know, 50 years. And I was thinking, I don't want to fuck that up.
Yeah, right. You know? Right, right. No, that's great that you feel that way.
I mean, there's no higher purpose as a designer, right?
Yeah, that's a testament to...
It's just like, who... I mean, I'd love to, like, to be a part of that.
Yeah.
You know? That to me is like, that's, it was an, like, I'm honored and I respect what you do, and I want to take care of it and protect it, right?
Yeah.
So,
did you know that the Beach Boys originally were named the Pendletones?
I did know that. It makes me wonder what would happen.
We should have like an anecdote off.
I know. So here's something I always think. I want to do this. So, because do you know about the there's the one like, you know, the legends of Portland, how it was named? It was able to be Portland,
sure,
or Boston.
Yeah, yeah, Boston. Yeah, yeah.
I'm there all the time, and I can't. No, this is terrible. my fifth grade teacher would slap me on the wrist for not remembering. I think it was Pettigrove and Lovejoy.
Okay.
Who they had the toy club?
Yeah, and, that sounds right.
And the guy, I think, is it Lovejoy or Pettigrove, is buried in that Pioneer Cemetery over there on Stark.
Okay.
Is the guy who lost the time? Can you imagine if this was actually called Boston, Oregon? How confusing that would fucking be! Like,
I think we lucked out being Portland. I mean,
anyway,
you want to be the bigger one?
I know, right? I'm like, Boston. Oh, Boston, Massachusetts. No, Boston, Oregon.
Oh,
no,
that's too bad.
So, yeah. I know. I keep thinking about those big what ifs.
Yeah,
big what ifs. But yeah, but,
I just found it fascinating that like, wasn't Brooklyn a separate city?
Brooklyn is,
or it was.
Really?
I mean, at some point,
you know, they call Portland they call Portland the sixth borough.
All right.
Yeah, but is it really? I wouldn't know that.
I think it was at some point, and then they just same for the Minneapolis was originally like St. Anthony.
Really?
And Minneapolis.
I know there's a big
they just merge. They're like corporations. They merge as they grow these cities.
Oh, they're like Well, I know, like with North and South Dakota, there's a big kerfuffle over one of them being the original Dakota and having to delineate themselves between North and South. One of them feels like they're just called Dakota, and the fact that they have to call themselves North and South is like an affront to.
There are more important arguments than that.
I mean, who cares?
Man? Yeah, really.
Right.
But, the problem is not.
Yeah, but no, you should. Jeremy is awesome. He's what I love about Jeremy. Talking about stories. Is he's actually his back? He went to college. He has a degree in anthropology, which I always thought, don't you?
Oh, that's hilarious! I interviewed an anthropologist last week for this.
Did you?
Who was a client of ours, Hunter Qualitative?
Yeah,
they do like That's I should definitely talk to.
Well, don't you think? I have far more fun talking about human behavior than I do about design.
Yeah, you know, I mean, right? Because you know, it's like,
why do you do what you do?
It's no design. It's right? Like I'm interested in what. Other stuff that just tangentially can contribute to my understanding of how design fits into the human experience.
Don't you love it when you have when something like when you're anointed with like the perfect solution, you go, oh, it wraps it all up in a nice little package.
Yeah,
this isn't like that you're so brilliant that you thought of it. It's just that it happened.
The reason
it's so fun is because you bring all this other stuff into it.
Yeah,
you know,
right. You just have to stay open to inspiration.
Totally.
And
so, what is Need? Where does that come from? Needmore? Where does that come from?
It actually came from the record label. I was really into Guided by Voices.
Yeah.
About a decade back, and their publishing company was Needmore Songs. And one drunken night, I noticed that, and I was like, "Oh, that's clever."
I know, right?
I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, one of my email addresses. I thought it was so clever. It's Bee Life. BLIFE, and that was a bite of who I thought at the time was A Life in Manhattan, down on Orchard Street. You know, like there's a shop down there called A Life or A Life, whatever they call it.
I do not know that.
Oh,
song.
The little boutique where they carried like, you know, really cool things, and they're kind of like one of the first kind of really hip New York boutiques about 10, 15 years ago.
I always think of you as Biz Bob.
Oh, it's and for the record, radio listeners,
yeah,
it's and this is my,
am I pronouncing it wrong?
This is my failed attempt because it's Busy Bobby.
Oh, okay.
Get it?
I do. No, I that makes more sense. Yeah.
but the guy I'm working with, Milos, calls me Biz. I'm like, oh, whatever. You know, it is what it, like it's, you know.
Yeah, that's
it's just whatever. It is what it is. So,
Cool. Well, we should. I guess we should wrap this up. I mean, you know,
how fun.
I'm paying by the minute here for the.
Oh my gosh!
Just kidding. Yeah, thanks for coming by, Bob.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
And Bob Smith, where can people find you? Are you mainly on Facebook? Or do
I'm
you
on
have
Facebook
any?
A lot. I have an archaic website with a PDF link, but mostly on Facebook or LinkedIn. Yeah.
Okay. Just keep an eye out
for BobSmithDesign.com.
Okay. Cool. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Raymond.
I found a bunch of Beach Boys bootlegs, which
that seems like a score.
Your review, your initial impressions were this sounds like bad karaoke, which it is. It's like a lot of them are like rehearsals.
No, I said it was better than karaoke.
Oh, better than karaoke. Yeah. Okay. I gotcha.
Because I think when I took my headphones off, whoever was singing, I don't know who that was on the mic, but
that was Al Jardine.
Okay. He was like a little flat. Like, yeah. It was kind of like.
It was like his first.
But it's still better than the worst or the best karaoke that you're going
to
hear.
Well, at least it was the actual singer. He was trying to sing Help Me, Rhonda, kind of figuring out where it would fit in his range, maybe. Mm-hmm. It is very interesting to hear how the. There's sometimes I'm always fascinated by really good vocal harmonies, whether it's the Eagles that we discussed last week or Beach Boys or. You know, even Bee Gees. What are those, like, dare I say it, super groups had really good vocal harmonies. And it's fun to hear them. Sometimes you can't tell who's singing what until you see, like, I found this live show of the Beach Boys, of the Bee Gees. And it totally made. I got who was singing what part. But before then, you can't really tell sometimes, you know. And same with the Beach Boys. You can see in the early takes that they're trying to figure out, you know, the mix isn't there. They're trying to figure out who should sing what part. And some of it's, you know, it changes up. And I love listening to Beatles bootlegs for that same reason, you know. Mm-hmm. Like just hearing them try out an alternate start to a song or a different ending or... Anyway, that's why I find that so interesting.
When I was 12, my favorite part of the entire Led Zeppelin catalog was at the beginning of... now I don't even remember. It's a song on Physical Graffiti that they recorded with the Stones mobile studio, and they were outside, like, in the yard recording, and a plane goes over. And you can't hear the question, but the question is like, all right, we'll start over or something. Should we start over? And Robert Plant says, no, leave it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's just like this really... And I was like, oh, I love... Like, it was like a nice... But I think, like, the idea of demos and outtakes, like, it obviously just, like, condenses that and makes it that much better. Like, that's all you're hearing.
That's all
and,
you
like,
get,
it's,
yeah.
I love... Every like, song it feels gets, like drawing the curtain in. Back a little bit. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. especially when, like... I've noticed in a lot of these that the assumption is that they'll... someone's riding the faders when they're doing the mix down. So like they'll try not to talk right next to a part where they're recording, but sometimes they'll just sort of be chattering like well before they're supposed to come in. And on a lot of the rough outtakes, they'll leave that in there. So it's just like, they're just like chatting. And at some point they're like making fun of the vocal track that's in there already. and then they like stop and they stop joking around and then they come in singing harmony with it. I just thought that kind of cracked me up. Mostly that doesn't make it into the final, but every once in a while you hear like a Beatles or a Beach Boys or something where there's something in there. You know, the Beatles, a lot of times there'd be this like dropout in the recording and you'd be like, why was there a dropout? Like, it'll be like a track that's just a weird one where they think no one will notice, like a clap track.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden the clapping or tambourine or whatever stops and then comes back in. And it's like, why did they do that? And then you'll hear the outtake and you realize, oh, someone like sneezed or like just broke out laughing or something. And they, rather than take the time to re-record it, they just figured, well, no one will miss the tambourine here. Which is funny in retrospect. It's so sloppy. Like, of course people are going to notice that.
It's so surprising that they would leave, like, they and George Martin, such perfectionists, it seemed like, that wouldn't happen.
It It happened mostly during like their sort of middle period, 65, 66, because they were getting into doing the overdubs, but they didn't have time. Like before Sgt. Pepper, they wouldn't like take months to get it right. So it was like they'd book out 4 hours to have to do a song. And if someone screwed up on an overdub and they were in their third hour, I was like, well, screw it. Just put it to tape, you know. Fix it in the mix, which in those days meant, you know, nowadays you might like sit down at the computer and splice in a part that was good or something. You know, you could fix it in the mix literally. You know, there it's just like, we'll just fade out that part. Or there's lots of weird parts on like the White Album and stuff where they'll like, you know, that song, Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except for Me and My Monkey. It's like, there's like this sort of weird guitar riff at the beginning, and then it's like, it jumps right into the song. Totally randomly. Like, why does it do it? It sounds good in retrospect. And you guess that someone punched in the tape and they listened to it on playback and they're like, that sounds fine. But it's like, it's not really on the beat or anything. It just suddenly the song starts after this riff. Listen back to that. It's like that.
Yeah, I don't think I know it well enough to like.
Dun, 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 and it's like, come on, come on. It's like randomly, like the whole song starts. Or like, there's like some ending of some song where they. Taxman, where they just arbitrarily punch in a whole. It's like not even like punching in a guitar solo. They're just splicing back the whole guitar, vocal, everything from the middle of the song at the end, because I think they just screwed up at the end or something. I love that stuff.
I wish that people could see the hand gestures. Like, it was like jazz hands gone. It was amazing. That was, I think your feet were out too. Like, it was great.
Yeah, so like lucky I didn't fall out of a chair.
Full starfish.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
The first Ryan Adams album, Ryan, yes. No B.
Yeah.
No. With like when he, after he left Whiskey Town, it was in his first solo album, which is called Heartbreaker, I think, or Heartbreak, something like that. It starts with him arguing with David Rawlings, Gillian Welch's like writing partner, about a Morrissey song and whether or not it's on a certain album. And that's like the first track on the song. And it's like 2 minutes long of them just like arguing about it, whether or not it's on a certain album. And I always wondered, like, if that was the, like, why would you start your first solo album with that? Like,
right.
And if it was that reason, like, oh, here's an outtake, and now here's like 11 sad bastard songs for like, here's an hour of mopey. It was always curious to me, but I'm now thinking about it in this context, like maybe it's just like look, here's that peek behind the curtain. Here's our
like famously that Dylan one where he's like, you know, he starts singing.
Mm-hmm.
On Highway 61, I was riding on the Mayflower. And then, like, literally after the first bar, realizes, oh, yeah, the band's not playing. The band didn't come in. He just breaks out laughing, and you can hear them all laughing. I think at some point, luckily before that in the sessions, the producer realized that Dylan did that kind of shit a lot and just put a mic in the middle of the room to catch that stuff, like when everyone was screwed up, because, you know, with Dylan, famously, you wouldn't get more than one take. Like, if you made it through the song, you had to accept that that was probably the one that was going on the album. Like, if it wasn't, if someone didn't screw up to the point where they had to stop it. Like, if you screwed up and that band kept playing, guess what? It's going on the album. Like, you just would never do the song twice, you know?
Yeah. Is it that album that Jeff Lynne plays piano on? And he was like 17 or something.
I'm not sure.
I remember reading like an interview with him, and he was just like, he asked me to see if I could come up with a line for like a melody line on the piano or on the keyboard or something. And I was trying to figure it out, and the band just came in while I was playing it, and that was it. That was on the album. Like, he
that
just
was like a Rolling Stone. It wasn't Jeff Lynne. It was the guy who played with the band.
Richard, who, right now all I can think of is Levon, who's a drummer.
Oh man, I'm not gonna
think. I'm actually thinking Richard Hugo, who's a poet, but not in the band. believe it or not.
Oh boy. You know, I'm not going to find it. It's not, Wikipedia's not helping me here.
Richard Manuel? Rick Danko? Didn't one of them play?
I don't know. They're not listing the people who are in the studio on this page. Oh, Al Cooper.
Oh.
Al Cooper.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. He improvised the organ riff, but he wasn't an organ player at that time.
Okay. That's what, and they just like...
Yeah,
they just said, trying to figure it out, and they were just like,
"That's it."
Went.
Yeah, okay. And it ended up being very much a trademark of the song, sure. You know. Yeah. But it's also like you can tell when you like the person playing that organ part is a musician, but they're not like pushing it. They're not like riffing off of it. They're like, "Okay, I'm just going to keep playing this part because Bob liked it," you know. You know, whereas like Robbie's obviously, you know, riffing,
right?
Yeah. Iconic. See the word iconic here. Wikipedia.
What are you looking at on Wikipedia?
It elevated Dylan's image to iconic. The song has been covered by numerous artists, varying from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, the Rolling Stones, the Wailers, to Green Day.
Green Day? All right.
I'm just going to let it sit there for a minute, let that sink in. Wow. Anything else that we should talk about, or should we let these nice people go?
Be free.
Okay. All right. See you next week.
Bye.